There is more to me, Queen Eliara of Elfgard, than my elven magic. Just as there's more to Geico than saving you money, Geico also gives you 24/7 access to licensed agents online, on the phone, or on the Geico app. And while I am a mighty elf queen, I am also a mighty big fan of barbecue potato chips. Minions! More smoky mesquite!
Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of What's on Draft. I am Mark Whittington, and I'm joined again this week by Cole Zwicker and Javier Pesquera, who's back from his one-week sabbatical, feeling much better and ready to go. We are excited for another pod this week. We're going to do a sort of mini mailbag, which we've not done before. We had a couple of people sending us questions after our last podcast went up. And we think a lot of them were pretty good. So we're going to try to cover those in depth, go over them a little bit, and then if there's time at the end, talk about the Lakers, which we have not had the opportunity to do, or talk about the Lakers like we talked about the Nuggets last week, and we haven't had the opportunity to do that with the Lakers yet. So that's the plan for the podcast, and let's do it. How are you guys doing?
Doing fine, like much better than last week, of course, and just like let you know, guys, that we're in episode 10 already, so this thing keeps rolling and rolling fast.
Yeah, I'm healthy for the first time in probably 2 weeks, so thanks to have Javier back, and yeah, seriously, gonna be out of the woods.
Cool. You guys watch any games this week that you were like really into?
I mean, I watched Washington against Arizona this morning, like the game from yesterday, and it was quite impressive to see Fultz finishing again. Like he had a couple of finishes against Arizona Bigs that he was just like finding space everywhere, like to use a spin and again when you think he's trapped. And that was really impressive. And other than that, Markkanen was back from his collapse shooting. Like he has been quite bad in conference play lately. And he had like an easy day against the Washington Bigs. That was my impression. That's the only game I watch in detail. I watched some of them live yesterday, but I don't really like watching live all that much. So we'll have to have more time during the All-Star break now.
My plan was to catch up over All-Star break for sure over the next couple of days from this weekend. I got to all last weekend's games. Gonzaga St. Mary's was pretty interesting because I have not seen Zach Collins yet. So he was pretty impressive. So that's really the only game notable that I've seen in recent history here.
Yeah, I watched that one too. I watched the Kentucky-Georgia game kind of. I was at a party and it was on TV for a little bit, so I was sort of paying attention. Javier, I started scouting a bunch of Lowry games over the last couple weeks, and like, I mean, every time I watch him, I'm obviously scouting, but like the last couple weeks, I was like, all right, I haven't really taken the time to go in depth on him. Let's do that. And it was right during that stretch that you were talking about where single game he was just so bad. It was like five or six straight games. And I was like, well, like obviously he's not this bad, but this does not bode well for someone that I was already down on anyway. So, if that Washington game is available soon, I will definitely be interested in watching that.
I mean, he's been playing some five, and he played some five against Washington as well. Like, they are down with Ristić being out. So he's been playing a bit more five, and I think it's interesting to see that a little bit at least to project. And I mean, it's just like difficult to judge him against the bigs from Washington because they can't really defend space that much. So it's a bit of a cupcake for him in terms of difficulty of the game, kind of.
Yeah, if you want a magical fix to Lowry's recent struggles, the UW front line is where you want to be. So
yeah, perfect.
Yes, especially who's is Dickerson out now or is it Malik Dime? Who is the guy who got suspended?
It's Dime, I think.
It was Dime.
Yeah, Dime's definitely the guy who got suspended. Yeah.
Yeah.
And already terrible front court just got worse. However many weeks ago, so yeah.
Yeah, he was out with his pinky, some type of injury before as well. So he's been a weird thing. Like he's been out for a while now.
All right, Cole, do you want to read the questions? Do you want me to read the questions? How do we want to do this?
I can do it. All right. It's fine with me. Our first one's from my buddy Naveen on Twitter at NGM1211. His account's protected, but just follow him anyway. He's a really good source. But this is more of a draft philosophy question. So he wants us to rank like the non-championship level stars who aren't willing to be championship level role players versus the player who is much more likely to be a role player, but not having that same star ceiling. So by example, I think what he's getting at least in his mind, is a Jason Tatum versus Jonathan Isaac, where Isaac has like a much higher floor maybe as a 3 and D player who has an established defensive skill set. We're pretty sure he can shoot threes consistently versus a Tatum who has probably a little bit higher of an upside to be a creation, especially at a triple threat in the mid post. And how do you rank those guys comparatively when we're like doing a big board? So Mark, you want to take it first?
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the question, right? Like, I don't know that Tatum's necessarily the best example here, because I think even if he doesn't reach his offensive upside, I think he still has some like pretty good utility for teams with championship aspirations. Also, wow, that hot streak. I'm just looking at his stats right now. Tatum's up to 38.9% from three after that ridiculous streak against UVA. So I don't know, that's encouraging. Anyway, sorry, just lost track of the question. So yeah, I think like this is a really, really tough question. I think a better example would be someone like Malik Monk for me, or Jamal Murray, someone who like clearly has utility in the league and someone who is going to stick around for a long time and, be like not be terrible, but someone who you're not going to want to treat as your top one or two players. And I'm still trying to figure out how to handle it, I guess. I mean, I think the easy way is to talk about it and to be clear about what your expectations are. Like, people will say, oh, like, Mark's so down on Malik Monk, which, I mean, I guess compared to a lot of people, I am. But I also, like, I don't think he's going to wash out of the league. I think he's going to have a 15-year career probably, and I think he's going to score a lot of points and be a really fun player to watch. But there's a... So it's, like... If you were talking to me about that, if we're having a discussion about like what I think players' utility is going to be, it's very easy to make that come across. But when you're just making a straight up big board or like ranking players, that's the sort of thing that often gets lost in people just like looking at numbers. And I'm not sure totally how to deal with it. I think the last couple years, what I've sort of just relegated those players below where I would have the ability to pick them in a lot of cases, preferring to punt on players who had a lower chance or were less likely to have an opportunity in the league. But I thought if they got that opportunity, would be more likely to be contributors. And I'm sort of trying to figure out how I want to handle it this year, because I'm not sure. I think, Cole, you put up a post a couple months ago, maybe, that sort of addressed this and convinced me a little bit that you do need to take opportunity into account, and you do need to think about how likely it is that a player is going to see the court and a player is going to be able to do what his skill set says he should be able to do.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that has definitely has merit. I mean, you have to see the court to have production and have a role. Like, there's a lot of very talented players that go by the wayside because they don't get opportunities. So that's just one critical factor you have to consider.
Yeah, I think there are different things here. Like, I was not going through the question thinking about Tatum and Isaac either, because I think Tatum, even if he doesn't pan out completely in terms of creation ability or even defense, like, I think he's going to give you enough to be a role player. I think he's adjustable there. I was thinking more about guys that can't really do much without the ball in their hands. Like, I was thinking specifically about De'Aaron Fox, if you are thinking about him as a high caliber prospect of a guy that is going to be drafted high enough. And it's more about, like, those guys, like, even if you draft them high enough, and that's a point with Monk as well, and they pan out in a way, you're going to be trapped with them a little bit economically, because you're going to want to keep them because they are draft picks from your own team, and you're going to end up probably paying them to a degree that is not really worth it in terms of, like, if they could be max players for some teams because of the lack of quality of play, or lack of, like, there is not max players for every team, so some players end up being overpaid. But you are going to end up trapped with those type of contracts and those type of players that really constrain your ability to build a team in terms of having a championship ceiling. And in that way, I think the most intriguing and most dangerous one is not even Fox, because it's like one of these examples that Mark was talking about, when you are not going to have that guy available where you think the value is right in terms of drafting him. It's more about Dennis Smith Jr. for me. Like, I like the guy, and I think the shooting, you have to trust the shooting 100% to be able to make that call and draft him like top 5, top 3. But like, if you are not 100% with that, and you are considering the downside he has in terms of like what the little things he doesn't do, the problems he has in defense, the problems he has with his focus, and sometimes with reading the floor and the games, like, he's another guy that can really like completely block your path to a championship level roster if you put all your horses on him as a prospect and as a leader for your team.
That's what came to mind for me when I interpreted this question. It was more Dennis Smith versus Lonzo Ball. That's kind of how I read it.
Yeah, totally.
I was like, Lonzo has that kind of championship caliber, like, a contribution with his off-ball shooting and his passing. You think that's going to be a safe, like, safe floor? Where Dennis Smith, he has more creation upside. He has more of a primary initiator upside. And he's the most dangerous player in the draft to me because he has that type of upside. So comparing him to Lonzo, that's been kind of like what the theme of the draft has become for me, is making that decision between those two. Because like we talked about, you can't miss on this high ceiling guy. So that's what the top of the draft is all about, finding that star upside. And hypothetically, Smith has that, but there are so many negatives now. The lack of instincts, like the lack of maybe potentially work ethic. I don't think the guy's like the most intelligent basketball player. So you have to weigh all those together. And yeah, if you miss on somebody like that, it's dangerous. Because, I mean, that can be your franchise player, or it can be a total tank.
I think that example just made me think a little bit about past drafts to which this might apply. And so I thought just a little about the 2011 draft, where Klay Thompson might be the analogous Lonzo Ball in this case, and like Kyrie Irving would be Dennis Smith. And so, like, looking at that draft, pretending that you are projecting Klay's defense accurately, which I think most people were not at the time. Not that I was doing this back then. But if you were reading Klay's defense as likely to translate, and Kyrie as having this primary creator upside, it's hard to value. It's very similar to Lonzo versus Dennis Smith, right? Where I think Kyrie clearly had a higher upside, which he has not reached, and Klay Thompson clearly was not as likely to be that franchise-altering player, but works really, really well as your second or third guy on that team. Really, really third guy for the Warriors. I think it's really hard to know when you go with one versus the other, and that's, I think, very much about when team preference will come.
No, that's right. Because if we're talking about other guys that can shoot, like when you were making the point about Monk, or even if you're talking about Lowry and stuff like that, like those guys, I think, like you said, Mar, like those are going to end up finding a niche in the league. Like, it's not that problematic with those guys. It's just more about if they are completely bombing out and they are not good enough to be like completely like focus of your offense, and if they can do much more. Like, I think, like Cole said, Smith is the most dangerous one. I think Fox would be the second one in this type of ranking if you are really going through Naveen's idea. And if you're going on the other side, like the guys that are safe or safer, Ball, obviously, like we've been talking about this for a while now, like labeling him as the safest guy on the board pretty much. And I think even if the debate between Tatum and Isaac is not really there for me, I do think that Isaac is a fairly safe prospect in this regard. Like, it's a guy that is going to be able to provide you with all the elite role player things that you are trying to find at this stage of the draft. And in terms of like the Klay and Irving comparison, I think if you have those in every draft, kind of, if you go back, like you can go back even to 2010, and you have Evan Turner being drafted too high and having like that type of problematic ceiling in terms of being able to actually have a high usage for a good team. And I think those are that's mainly the big question in every draft. Like, if the guy is good enough to actually be a guy with a high enough usage to be your focal offensive point, right? And if he's not, is he able to do something else or not? Like, that's where everything boils down to, and where you can make monumental mistakes, and you have to scout right for that.
Yeah, we talk all the time about the value of being a primary initiator, but conversely, you don't want to have the wrong primary initiator. Like, Detroit's finding that out with Reggie Jackson. And if you have like an average point guard or above average point guards don't, like Javier made this point off air the other day, point guards typically don't lead to championships. I mean, even the best ones like Chris Paul, who's a generational point guard, haven't resulted in that. There are only a handful that do. So if you have the wrong one and you hit your wagon to him completely, like, that's a problem. And so that's why we have to start considering maybe Lonzo Ball as an off-ball guard who can situationally handle, of course, and run a pick and roll and all that stuff. But like, his value off the ball, bringing that kind of lead guard skill to the wing, being able to shoot and pass at a really high level on a good team, that could be more influential than Dennis Smith on like a bad team or a mediocre team.
Yeah, but like,
yeah, I think yeah. That's a really important point, Cole. And like, to, I think one of the biggest mistakes that teams can make is thinking that they have the guy before they actually do. Right? Like, I mean, some people might disagree with this characterization of the Pacers, but like, I think Paul George is not that guy. I think he tops out as the second best player on a championship team, and he's going to be really, really good in that role if he's ever able to play that second banana role. But I think he's not good enough to be that top guy. And so the Pacers trying to base their entire team around him as that guy really limits what they're able to do. And I think that's a mistake that a lot of teams make when it comes to team building. And one of the hardest things to try to understand the difference between, like, do I have a second tier guy who can initiate well, but not at the level that I need? Or do I actually have that first tier guy? And that's a really, really important thing to understand as team building and as a general manager when you're like evaluating what your team is.
Yeah, but like in that venue, in that line, like, I think you have to be able to draw a line in terms of like where the difference is and at what point is more valuable to have an elite role player or a iffy initiator, because like some teams are not in the business of just competing for the championship or bust. Like, if that's the line we're going to draw, like, we're going to end up with half the league tanking every year, because that's the only way to do it. So like, in the end, like, we're going to have teams that have to get the revenue, have to get enough money every year, and they have to try to reach for the playoffs, even if it's not the way to do things. So you're going to have to give a little extra value to those flaw initiators, because they are going to be useful for some teams. Like, even if Dennis Smith is not a championship level star or championship level second star or wherever you want to put the line at, like, he's going to have some value if he pans out as an initiator for some teams. Like, I know that it's not where you're looking for in terms of winning the chip, but like, that's something that you have to take into account, because teams are going to take that into account when they draft.
Definitely. And like, I think the Kyrie Clay example, yeah, Mark, was brilliant. I think that hits the nail right on the head. I think every team would have taken Kyrie over Clay. I mean, there's no question, just because that creation upside was there. But I mean, it took Kyrie until LeBron came to really be a winner. And he had like a supernova finals and stuff like that, and he was fantastic. I'm not taking anything away from him, but it took like another primary, like the primary, to get him over the top. So when we're comparing guys like Dennis Smith, like, he's probably going to need a lot of help. And you can't just go into it thinking, this guy, we're going to turn our entire offense over to him, probably, because from what we've seen, he's not at that level right now.
Hi, this is Maury Moreland Morrison, here to tell you GEICO has more than just great savings. Much more. Yes, while GEICO could help you rack up more moolah faster than you can say metamorphosis, they've also been the fastest growing auto insurer for more than 10 years. That's more like it. Furthermore, GEICO has fast and friendly claim service. That might seem like an oxymoron, but it's not. All the more reason to say no other auto insurer has more than GEICO. GEICO. Expect great savings and a whole lot more. Hi, this is Maury Moreland Morrison, here to tell you GEICO has more than just great savings. Much more. Yes, while GEICO could help you rack up more moolah faster than you can say metamorphosis, they've also been the fastest growing auto insurer for more than 10 years. That's more like it. Furthermore, GEICO has fast and friendly claim service. That might seem like an oxymoron, but it's not. All the more reason to say no other auto insurer has more than GEICO. GEICO. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
All right. So, if anybody doesn't have, does anybody have any other points before we move on?
Or? I was about to say I'm out of points on this.
Yeah. Me too. All right, let's go to the second question here from Steve at Steve43. How about accountability? What pick did you nail in the past few years? Who did you miss badly? Any kind of learnable mistakes or outliers? So, Javier, why don't you take this one?
Well, it's difficult to say from last year because it's only been like half a season or even, like, I mean, third quarters of the season. But I think I was high on Juancho Hernán Gómez all year long. And I think I've been proved at least right in terms of being a higher upside guy than some people thought. I see the points and the problems with his defense, but I was really not that worried about that early on. And then, like, I've been high on Ivica Zubac as well from the Lakers. I was high early in the process from him. So those are the guys I've been good at last year, I will say. In terms of being wrong, I was too low on Jamal Murray. Probably I had him, like, outside the lotto. I had him close to top, like, the backside of the top 20. So that's probably the main case. And Thonmaker has looked much better than I thought he was going to be in terms of how he advanced his, in terms of his shooting ability. I was not really all that sold with his shot. And also, I would say Mako from Golden State was a guy that we all were kind of higher on that where he ended up being drafted. We're talking about, like, completely fails. I think 2015 was that draft for me. Like, I was higher on Okafor and Porzingis. Porzingis has panned out well, but, like, I was higher on both than in Karl-Anthony Towns. And in my view, with the thing with Okafor and the main mistake I made was basically projecting more than really trusting my eyes. Like, I was really projecting his skills on one end of the floor to be able to develop okay defensively because he had, like, quick feet and ability to move around the floor on offense, and I thought he was going to be able with coaching and some learning some learning curve to be able to be a factor defensively with his size as well. So that was probably my main problem. And another guy that really copes with our first question about, like, difference between being an initiator and elite one or not with Mudiay, like, I was high on him as well, and he hasn't been, like, all that good so far. I know it's a bit too early to judge all these players. It's been only 1 year and a half for most of them at most. But, like, if we're talking about recent drafts, those are my main guys, I would say.
Mark, what about you?
Yeah. Well, I would prefer not to really. Like 2016, I think it's too early to really say.
Yeah,
say
it is, yeah.
For sure.
It looks like, based on what I've seen so far from the class of 2016, I don't think I'm going to get burned by anyone. But I also don't know if any of the guys that I, like, pegged to overachieve where they were being drafted are going to actually do that. So it's too soon for me to really say. In terms of 2015, there was an awful lot that I missed on. I'll start with what I got right, and I feel really pretty good about it in retrospect. I was one of the earliest movers on Karl-Anthony Towns. I had him above Okafor from basically the first time in like late November, early December, like the first time I thought about who should go at the top of the draft. I had him ahead of Okafor. I was low on Okafor all year long, and I was right to be. I feel good about being lower on him than consensus was. I should have trusted my gut more. I had him, I think, seventh or eighth, and I should have just realized that I was with it and dropped him way down below that. But I feel good about, like, having recognized that and having gotten that dichotomy correct at the time. And then another big guy who I was definitely more right on than I think most of the draft community was Miles Turner, who I had probably fifth or so. And he went 10th. Like, I was, I thought the Magic should have taken a stab at him at number 5. He's turned out good. His shot looks real and he's protecting the rim, and you know, those are the two things that it's really important for him to be able to do. And he's useful because of that. You might say that I missed on almost everyone else in that draft. I did not do well. And I think part of that, so I've thought a lot about that draft. I've sort of returned to it a bunch. And
There's a couple different reasons why I missed. I think the first is that I had not yet realized what I came to realize last year before putting together my final boards, which was that almost everyone is bad. I had really bought into the idea of draft hype and like, these guys aren't going to miss. Like Stanley Johnson and Kelly Oubre are going to be really useful at the very least. Like they're wings. Like, why should I think they won't be able to get to like a Paul George level or something like that? Which, I mean, in retrospect, was idiotic, right? So I think part of it was not adjusting my expectations in a realistic manner at the time. And then there were sort of, I think there were are two players who I really missed on, who I missed on for the same reason, and it was a really important lesson that I've taken away, which were Kristaps and Devin Booker. And that year, I was much more stat. I relied on stats more. I thought those were more important than what I was seeing with my eyes, and so I was really unimpressed with both of them because statistically they had some big red flags and their good stuff didn't stand out very much. Like Porzingis was a 33% 3-point shooter and couldn't rebound, and the passing was like horrible, like terrifying. And Devin Booker, the only thing he did when he was at Kentucky was shoot. He was a spot up shooter. That was it. And so for both of them, I think the lesson that I've taken away from them is to understand the difference between what a player can do and what a player is asked to do. And I think that's something that's really hard to understand or to evaluate correctly, I guess, and something that is making me really think about Frank Ntilikina in a different way. Because I think for both of them, their statistical profiles undersold what they were capable of doing. And it was not because they couldn't do it. It was because their teams didn't want them to. Right? Devin Booker was played as consistently probably the third or fourth ball handler and maybe the fourth or fifth option offensively whenever he was on the court on that Kentucky team. So of course his stats showed him as someone who only shot because that was the only thing that they asked him to do. And Porzingis, they was just sort of used as an off-ball option at Sevilla as well. It looked like, and this is something that had I like understood standardizing assist rates for usage. I think his flag would have been a little less scary in that regard, but it was the same thing where he just wasn't asked to play that same way. And so with Frank this year, his statistical profile doesn't look very good at all. And I think it's a very similar thing to both of those players where he's asked to be more of a spot up threat and an off ball player. And so it doesn't highlight his on ball ability to the same degree that it would have were he playing in China or were he playing in the NCAA or were he playing in so many other different roles. So that's sort of been an important takeaway for me. And then I have a couple more misses, but I'll throw it to you for a little, Cole, because I've just talked for a while.
I think for me, it comes down to 2015 as well and just not trusting my gut enough there. Like, I had Okafor the lowest, I thought, until I heard Mark had him 7th. I had him 6th, and I just was not a believer in him at all. But I just didn't have the confidence yet in my eye test to really lower him any lower than that. But I wish I did in retrospect. And the same kind of goes for Moutier. I had him 8th. So that whole Russell-Moutier debate, I didn't think it was close. And I think that's proven to be right. Not because Russell's been so good, but because Moutier's been so bad. Just definitely red flags for there. That fits into the archetype series that I created 2 years after that. So That's kind of helped me sort through some of the misses from this recent draft. We've talked about Jamal Murray. I'm not sure it's going to actually come back to bite me just because I don't see that like high ceiling start power. But I probably didn't afford him enough credit pre-college as far as his handling ability, his pick and roll kind of prowess, his passing. I don't think he's going to be able to get separation like we talked about last week on the podcast. But giving more credit to pre-college play is something that I've taken away. Trying to get to watch these guys at like Adidas Nations, Hoop Summit in person, and trying to sort out over time how do they develop. I mean, I definitely missed some things with Jaylen Brown, I think, like before college and stuff, just because he was so bad at California. But when you're judging a guy on, you know, 1 year of production, you're going to samples are going to vary. We're going to see this with D'Angelo Russell as far as shooting off the dribble when you talk about the Lakers. Like, some samples can be heightened in 1 year, some can be lessened, and you don't really get the full grasp. So getting more of that pre-college look was going to be beneficial to me.
Yeah, and it happens even with guys that stay longer in college, right? Like, I was really high on Willie Cauley-Stanning during his freshman year at Kentucky, and then through the years, like, I ended up being quite low during the 2015 draft, and some people had him top 10, some people had him top 5 even. I was really low on him. I think I had him really in the backside of the top 20, and I think I've been proven right there, and I think it's just, like, difficult even to judge guys after 3 years of production, because the sample fluctuates a lot. Like, it depends specifically in those archetypes and the type of guy you're judging as well. But like, I think in terms of misses, like, you have to try to be as objective as you can. Like, I think that's the main issue with me. Like, the guys that I tend to like, or the guys I am like trending to end up like hyping, kind of like the guys I like, for some reason I end up like trying to make excuses for their flaws, and I think I totally did that with Okafor, for example, and I have tried to move on from that and maybe swing too much on the other direction, but I've been trying to be as objective as I can lately, and that's my take out of my misses, kind of.
Yeah, I think the small sample is a really good point, and something that's really, really hard is as we watch these guys over their college season, usually single season, it often feels like there's not a whole lot more to be learned while we're watching them, or at least it does to me. Like, we'll watch Lonzo Ball, and we've talked about this before, like, it's almost like he's the same player, and he like hasn't really changed from game 5 to game 7. And that's true, but at the same time, there's always the benefit of just bigger sample. We can always get a bigger sample. Like, and Lonzo Ball's a really good example here as well. Like, he might be an elite 3-point shooter. His percentages suggest that he is, or his 3-point shooting percentage suggests that he is, but also we're only dealing with a small sample here, and his free throw percentage suggests that he's not. And we really, I think it's fair to treat him as though he will shoot, but we don't really know. Like, there's entirely a possibility that we'll be wrong there, and all we can do is sort of look at a bunch of different indicators and try to read into that the best that we can, which also leads me into someone who looks like he was probably a miss on my part in the 2015 draft, although there's still a chance for him to turn it around and make me look better, but that's Justice Winslow. He's sort of my ultimate, like, be wary of 3-point percentages story. Because I thought he was going to shoot in the NBA. He shot really well at Duke, from deep, only from deep. And I liked so much else of what he did as a player that I was like, you know what? I don't care about the free throw percentage or the 2-point jumper issues. Like, I think he's going to shoot. And if he shoots, he's going to be a really good player. Well, here we are 2 years later and he has not shot at all. It's just something that I tend to be very wary of now. Like, you don't want to overrate small samples of noisy shooting, and then have that factor in a large way into how you're evaluating someone, because it can really change the outlook for certain players.
Totally. We've talked about Winslow before as an example for that, right? And it's another guy that you can judge under the same look as Cole was saying about, like, watching guys before their college seasons, because Winslow was playing with USA basketball. He had, like, several tournaments he was playing at, and he was never able to shoot it from the outside. So I think it's just another example there that you can cope with that theory, that you can just like try to see if the guy's a natural shooter or not, and trying to get the right view on him and watch him as much as you can in terms of other competitions as well, because he caught fire late in the season for Duke as well, like playing the four, and then you are not going to be able to judge as much, like you said, with being an outlier percentage and plus the free throw shooting. So it's a very good one, I would say.
Yeah, Winslow's a great example. I was actually going to bring him up too, just because I suffered from the same kind of, you know, issue was the high three-point shooting, and you saw him play, and he made a lot of plays, and that's kind of transferred over to how I view somebody like OG this year before injury and stuff. And Winslow had much more playmaking to fall back on, but OG just didn't have that free throw percentage indicator. Like, he shot pretty well from three last year, but it was on a ridiculously low sample, so just not completely buying into that. But I'd just say overall, just a lesson, just watch games. Like, this is the first year that I've watched college basketball from the start. Last year, I kind of just tried to catch up after the NBA season and stuff on YouTube, and you just miss too much of the picture when you do that. Like, you can see somebody's best game, you can see somebody's worst game. You just don't know unless you collectively look at the entire sample and follow these guys pretty thoroughly, like we've done via the show especially. It just drives you to watch weekly. You look for little things, intricacies in their games, and it just helps you formulate a much better picture. So that's what I would say.
One more guy that I missed on that I want to talk about quickly. Well, two guys that I missed on. I remember why I had them grouped together. So I missed on Mario Hezonja and Emmanuel Mudiay. And this is actually similar to what you said, Cole, where I know Cole and I have talked about this before. We both missed on Mario Hezonja, where we thought he was going to be really good, but we both successfully assessed that he was really just a spot-up shooter who didn't bring much beyond that and was bad on defense. And somehow, even though I accurately understood what his skill set was, I failed to sort of translate that to actual impact in the NBA. And I was like, I don't care that he's only a one-skill guy who brings a lot of negatives beyond that. He's definitely got star potential. That's a mistake that I will not be making again anytime soon. I think if I see guys with similar skill sets to Mario Hezonja, I will not have them anywhere near as high as I had Hezonja back then. And that's because, similarly to Cole, which is why I really like what Cole's done with his website, last year I started thinking about players more in terms of what role they're going to play in the NBA. And how their impact is derived from that role. And that sort of change in scouting mindset really impacted the way that I view a lot of these players, like Mario Hezonja or like Emmanuel Mudiay as the non-shooting point guard who needs to bring all of his value through offense. So I think those are two players that I missed on in 2015, would not have missed on in 2016, and am unlikely to miss on going forward in terms of overvaluing them when there are other players with a more probable chance of two-way impact still on the board.
Hi, this is Maury Moreland Morrison here to tell you Geico has more than just great savings, much more. Geico's been around for more than 75 years, back when they were using Morse code. Sorry, that's just my sense of humor. What's more, with Geico, you get 24/7 access to licensed agents on the app, online, or over the phone, so you can talk to them at night or in the morning. So forevermore, just know that no other auto insurer has more than Geico. More power to you. Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good place to wrap that question up. I completely agree with that. That's kind of why I made the archetypes, was to avoid mistakes like that. If you're a shooter, like, be that generational off-screen kind of J.J. Redick type, or what we think Malik Monk can be. And those are like really subtle intricacies to some people, but they are very, very important in the league. Like, J.J. Redick made his career sprinting off a screen, squaring up really quickly, and launching shots. Like, if you can't do that, if you can just spot up, you're Anthony Morrow, and you know that coach is not going to trust you on defense, so you're just not going to have a pivotal role. So that's a good place to end. Let's move on to the third question here from Brian Kuza at Brian_Kutza. As a fan of a very successful NBA franchise, he's obviously a Philadelphia fan, so that's a bit of a troll, but it's not going to be pretty soon. What player should I hope my team drafts in the late first round? So we've covered a lot of these guys, so Javier, you want to go at who you would target there?
Well, it's a really difficult question nowadays because, like, with the new rule, you don't really know who is going to be there or who is going to even declare, right? If you are projecting everybody to declare, it's a different thing. But, like, if we're talking about, like, guys that I'm seeing the composite rankings from every website that supposedly has some type of insight, and those are the ones you are supposed to trust in this regard. Like, for me, Josh Hart is ranked super low, respective where I will pick him. Like, he's even in the second round in some places, and I don't really know if he's going to go that low, but if he's there in the end of the first round, I will definitely nab him, and he's a guy that is going to be available because he's a senior. And, like, those guys are the ones I will focus. I will focus on wings that can do a little bit of everything, or guys that you can think will translate at least one skill to the next level and can play on the wing, because the upside there in the end of the first for me is with players like that. Like, if you're going to end up picking up a big, unless you are convinced that he can be a starter, I don't really see the point. I will just wait and maybe buy a second round pick. And I would just try to nab as many wings as possible. And if, like I said, like, if Hart is there, like, there are others, but OJ falls, for example, because of the injury and end up in that range. I don't really think he will, but, like, it might be a possibility. And, like, even guys like Grayson Allen, like, I think he's gritty and he might be able to do some on ball, even if he's not, like, he doesn't have the handles or anything like that, but, like, he can go in transition, can go hard and really go sprint. So I think he's a good enough shooter to be a prospect in that range as well. I would just probably target as many of those as possible and scout those deep and see who might be there, because it's really difficult right now to really say, like, if this guy is going to declare or not, because it's just, like, too early, and plus with the same rule, where they can declare and go back and not lose eligibility or anything like that. It's just too easy for them to test the market. Like, another guy, like, we talked about him a little bit a couple weeks ago, Donovan Mitchell. I've seen him there as well. I would totally be on board with him that late or even earlier. I think he can be a steal at that stage.
Yeah. I think you made a really good point in the types of players that you look for in the late round, or that I would look for in the late round. I would absolutely, like, two-way wings. Like, they may not, if they play defense and you think they might be able to shoot, take a shot at them in the late round. Like, to me, the defense is a really important part of that. But, like, yeah, I'm 100% there with Josh Hart, Donovan Mitchell. I would add, he probably isn't going to come out, but I would add Andrew Jones to that. Mikal Bridges, obviously. I think most years, I don't think there are that many of these guys this year. Like, if Justin Patton or Robert Williams are still there, absolutely one of those guys. But those types of slightly undersized but really efficient rim runners who can protect the rim, and can play, like, a really good backup center role on your team, always a worthwhile player to have there. Another two-way wing that I would, who's not even projected to get drafted by a Draft Express or ESPN right now, I think. But another two-way wing I would look at the end of the first round, and definitely in the second round, is Jeremy Morgan, who I know I've talked about on our big board, podcast from a couple weeks ago. Who plays for Northern Iowa. He's a really good wing defender. He has very few ball skills, but he moves the ball and he shoots. And, like, that's easily there. Like, there's a very viable path to him becoming an impactful player with that skill set. And then the one other thing I would look for at the end of the first round is players who are devalued for some reason. So that could be, like, Harry Giles, depending on how far he slides, who has not been very good this year. And we might talk about him some more later, but, there are mitigating circumstances for why he has not been good. So it's in the late 20s where the expected return on whatever your draft pick is very low anyway, it's worth taking a shot on him and hoping that it's because his athleticism hasn't come back fully yet, and when he gets it back, he'll be largely improved. And then my other two guys would be Ethan Happ and Dietrich Lawson. I think are both really worth looking at the end of the first round, who are both just statistical monsters, who are really exciting for what they've been able to do in college, but sort of and are really, really well rounded because of that, but have some sort of flag that limits them from generating that same sort of NBA enthusiasm. For Dietrich Lawson, it would be his athleticism. He's a slow player who this might lead us into the next question, but he tested really poorly at the NBA Combine last year, which turned a lot of teams off of him. But he's really well-rounded. He plays great defense. He's long. He blocks shots. He shot better from deep last year than he has this year. But there's a possibility that he can be a stretch four who brings some rim protection and has vision on the move. And like, if a player has all those skills and just has something that makes teams concerned about him, I'd take a swing on him there. Same with Ethan Happ, who it can do literally everything on a basketball court except for shoot. And like, the shooting thing is a big deal, but if he figures it out, then you've got yourself a star. So I would take a shot on either of those two guys at the back of that round as well, just because the expected return on those picks is so low that there's no reason not to swing on someone who has a high bust rate, but also a high star rate.
Yeah, I mean, you guys both hit on pretty much every guy and the philosophy that I would do. Definitely targeting those two-way wings, like the Chris Middleton, Jay Crowder types that have fallen through the cracks, maybe the upperclassmen. Like, if Josh Hart is there, that's a great pick. So those kind of guys. I struggle most of all with where to draft backup centers. Like Ivan Rabb, I don't know where to take him. I guess you can take him late 20s, and that's fine because the expected return at that point is not that high. But you can find those guys in the second round. Backup point guards are another one. Like Juwan Evans, I think he's going to be a really good NBA backup point guard. He can score. He can pass out of pick and roll. He's really good in pick and roll. So that's kind of what separates him from other guys like Montan Morris, maybe, who can't score. So I would target him around that area, even though I don't really see his like starting caliber effectiveness on a good team. I think he's more of a backup, but he can thrive in that role.
No, but there's upside in having a guy that can, like, having point guards for 48 minutes of a game. So that's a good point there. I would totally consider that. And to Mark's point, like, I understand the upside thing, like with some guys, and in Giles, I think it applies, but like, some people are going to apply that to guys like Marcus Bolden or Terrence Ferguson. I think there you are completely stretching it and you are going a little bit overboard. And there are guards that haven't really sold that much in terms of like having that supposed upside. And those are the type of guys like Scal last year or Perry Jones a few years ago. Like, the media is going to go completely bananas about those picks if they fall to the end of the first round. And I would be completely like, just like, bias, like, I don't really care about those guys. And I think it's like, you are most likely losing a pick. Like, there was a point about this, I think it was Kayser Lindemann that wrote an article about it. Like, you are trying to reach or trying to get like the most, like the highest upside guy even in the late rounds, but like, you have to consider that those guys, like, if they are not producing during their rookie contracts at all and they are not going to be able to see the floor, you're going to end up with a difficult decision at the end of those contracts. And if you are letting them go and they pan out afterwards, you are going to look completely stupid. And if you retain them or overpay them, you're going to look like Portland with Meyers Leonard. So I think that's a point to be made there, and you are going to have to make that decision at one point during the draft.
Yeah, that's another good point. I completely agree with that. But we don't see upside in kind of the same way as the national media does. So those guys, they just know the names. Those are name guys. Yeah. And so when they, like, Perry Jones is a great example. When he dropped, everybody was like, oh my God, I can't believe he's still available. And there's definitely a reason he dropped. So, I mean, I don't view upside that way. But let's move on to the – oh, go ahead, Mark, sorry.
Oh, Perry Jones was just terrible. Like, Perry Jones had no upside because he was never good at basketball. So, like – I don't know. Like, I think that's a really important point. Yeah, like, upside should refer to people who actually have demonstrated concrete basketball skills at some point in their careers, which, you know, is not Scalabissiere, is not Perry Jones, and it is guys like Dietrich Lawson or Ethan Happ who just have, like, things that might be holding them back that if they can overcome, they'll explode.
Yeah, and Marcus Bolden isn't any good either, so we should add that in.
But, yes, yes.
Hey, guys. I want to take time out of the show briefly to tell you a little bit about Almighty Baller's newest sponsor, Handy.com and the Handy app. My favorite apps are the ones that are simpler and make life easier, and Handy does just that. As most people obviously don't know, because that'd be incredibly creepy, I do this podcast out of a makeshift studio in my man cave, which unfortunately was recently flooded. I thought it was a drainage leak from multiple faucets. It ended up being a construction issue requiring the use of a handyman. Regardless, the Handy app had a solution and was so easy to use that I referred my landlord to it. The app has different interfaces, home cleaning, handyman, plumbing, electrical, and interior paint. It's a really easy process, guys. You just select a general category such as plumbing, describe the job in detail, select an appointment time, and provide a zip code and credit card information, and ultimately just select from a list of pre-approved services. It's really that easy. Handy is helping Almighty Baller keep What's On Draft on the net by sponsoring the network, and by offering listeners the following. 50% off cleaning services using the code ALMIGHTY50, 15% off handyman plumbing and electrical services using the code ALMIGHTY15. Handy is the quickest, most reliable way to book household service providers. Within a couple of minutes, you can book a pre-approved cleaner or handyman for any time you'd like. Again, the codes are 50% off cleaning services using the code ALMIGHTY50 and 15% off handyman, plumbing, or electrical services using the code ALMIGHTY15. Thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
Let's move on to the next question from Brandon Glecklin at Brandon Glecklin. This is just a question of how we view the role of athletic tests in our evaluation. And I guess I'll take this one to start just really briefly. It's been shown that like no step vertical translates. So as athleticism goes, like you look at the numbers, I don't really have like an overarching system. It's not like the NFL where they have like the spark score and stuff like that. You don't get really in-depth like one number stats when it comes to athleticism. It's more just wingspan and no step vert for me that I look at, obviously height and that stuff. But I don't really put that much emphasis in like the agility drills and like the ancillary things, because you can see that stuff on the court. Like I don't need to, I mean, if De'Aaron Fox tests poorly somehow in the agility drill, I don't know if that's possible. It's not going to change my outlook on his lateral quickness. So really I just look at like a couple of overarching points, like the important stuff, wingspan, height, and then the no-step vert, and kind of formulate my opinion from there. What about you guys?
Javier, you want to go first?
No, yeah, I would agree. Like, I don't really take into account the agility or the speed tests, because in the end, like, for a lot of those guys, if they're going to have the ball in their hands when they attack, like, it's different to be as fast without the ball than with the ball, and that's a part of it. And then when you're talking about defense, like, yeah, agility is important, but you have to navigate through guys. Like, it's not only moving around cones and moving side to side. Like, it's also taking into account that you have guys on court and you're going to have to go through that. So, yeah, I take a wingspan and height into account. I take body fat and strength. Like, I think that's important with some guys, especially older guys that you don't know how much room for improvement they have physically. And that's pretty much it. Like, I think the non-step vert is interesting as well, but like, I think it's mostly about like if the guys have like the right length to play their position or to play somewhat of okay defense in terms of big, especially on front court players. And if you're talking about the smaller guys, it's more about like the type of physique they have, if they are athletic enough, and if they have the type of frame that you want, or you're going to be they're going to be able to develop there. And you have to take it into account with age as well.
Yeah. So I think you guys are I think the question was specifically about athletic tests. I think we all are in agreement that the measurements matter.
Yeah.
In terms of determining like position and functionality a lot of times, and like what's really important with the measurements is that intersection between utility and like absolute size, because as we've talked about before, like you can have ideal measurements for a position and people will talk about your defensive upside because of it. But if you're not using your length and your size to generate steals or blocks or deflections or to get in passing lanes, it doesn't matter that you have all that length because you're not using it correctly. So, I mean, we've obviously talked a lot about that. And so, like, to me, like, the measurements are important in determining where people play and how successfully they'll fit into those roles. But not much more than that. The athletic tests themselves, I really don't put much stock into. I think they're most useful in determining who sort of the low end baseline, if that makes sense. Yeah. Like I don't think the high end is very yeah. useful at all. Like the highest jumpers the last 2 years were Demetrius Jackson and Pat Connaughton, both from Notre Dame. Like, all right, that doesn't mean anything. But what I think is more useful is guys who are outlier low athletes for their position. Like, everything is always going to be relative to position for me. And so that is what the worry for Dedrick Lawson is for me, is he was an outlier poor athlete across the board for a power forward wing. And Daniel Hamilton was another guy like that who I liked decently last year and was just an outlier poor athlete across the board for wings. And he had enough other concerns that, like, seeing all of that come through was enough to really make me concerned about how he would be able to play in the NBA. So I think that's what I really use the athletic tests most for, is just determining a base threshold of athletic ability that says you can function in the NBA as you are as an athlete. Now, what are your skills beyond that?
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, I think that's basically the case, right? You have to take those to be able to put a baseline in terms of being able to play at the next level. That's the main issue there.
Yeah, I like that. It's like a summer league analogy too. Like, you just, summer league doesn't tell you who's good; it tells you who can't play in the league. So, I think that kind of operates with the same methodology. But I'm a fan of that. Let's move on to the next question real quick. Brett Greenberg at Jungle to Brett. Do you go back and watch any past college guys to determine stars or busts? Do you identify any trends? I'm going to let Mark start here because I know he went back and watched some Iguodala to compare him to Josh Jackson a while back, maybe on the first couple podcasts. So,
yeah, I forgot about that. I was going to say, no, I don't really do that, but I guess you're right. It's smart. I think it would be it's not something that I've done extensively, no. I did look back at some Iguodala tape because I was intrigued to compare him to Josh Jackson a little bit. The tape was so blurry that it was really kind of hard to see, and Arizona played a zone the whole time, so I couldn't really get a read on his defense. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly something that I think could be utilized more, and is a smart way of thinking about things, and something that I think like during off season is sort of a useful way to reacquaint yourself with players who were successful and to look at. To like think about why that might have been, but it's certainly not something that I've used extensively, and probably a place that I could take advantage of a market inefficiency, if you will.
Yeah, I haven't done it either that much. I get the point. Like, especially when they would all I think it's interesting to compare guys to current guys in the current draft class. Like, that's a really interesting area, and if you are working on it as a professionalist, kind of, you can do it over the summer as well. But like, I have done it a little bit only, and what I have is just with guys I miss completely on, that like we talk about, like Carl Anthony Towns and guys like that, or even guys that I miss on the other side of the spectrum, like Trey Burke or those type of players that I were higher on, and just check why I was missing the boat there, or trying to come up with an answer. And that was mainly the case for me, but I think it's interesting to just even draw comparisons to guys from today's class, and that's a good point right there.
Yeah, I have a really simple answer to this. I just don't have the damn time to do it. Like, it's so hard to keep up with NCAA games and NBA games and, like, some high school stuff. So, like, having the time in the day to go back and watch past prospects, ideally, I love the question. I think it's a great idea because you catch little intricacies with their games. It's just, it's really hard to fit that all into, like, a regiment when you actually have a job. So, like, it's tough. But
and you want your summer vacation as well, so...
That too, man, that's important.
Yeah,
I mean, that's why I think if I were to do it, it would be the off-season, because I just don't think there's all that much value in, like, summer league and most of what happens over the summer. So, for me, like, I would be most interested in learning in, like, a couple months in July. Like, let's go back and look at Carl Anthony Towns and see why, like... how fluid he was back when he played in Kentucky, or like maybe Devin Booker did show some flashes that I just didn't bother paying attention to and wrote them off or something along those lines. But yeah, I mean, really interesting thought. I guess we're just not smart enough to do it.
Well, it'd be good, because by now, at least some of us have written scouting reports up and done video breakdowns only in recent years, though. For me, like, just a little bit of last year and this year. So it'd be nice maybe in, like, a couple years to go back and have, like, a quick kind of study. Like, what did these guys do well in college? What did we identify? And have it, like, a faster kind of read and react piece than having to parse through an entire game. But just be like, oh, this he could do this then. And that, I think that would be useful. All right, so let's go. Next question from Diego Rubio at Diego Rubio 02. Thoughts on Doncic and the entire 2018 class overall, Javier? Let's start with you.
Well, for the 2018 class, like, I haven't really seen as much as probably you guys, especially with high school guys. I've seen much of Doncic. Like, I try to watch as much as I can. He's actually playing in like 20 minutes. We're recording now at, 6 p.m. European time, and the Spanish Cup went on under the weekend. So the final is today. He plays Valencia. He was really good in the semifinal and quarterfinal. They defeat Baskonia yesterday in a overtime game. And, like, I think the main take with both Doncic and the main issue here is not considering him. Is he going to be a good or not good player? Like, it's the same question with Ball. It's more about, like, if you see the high-end talent and you see enough to consider him a franchise-level talent. And I have a couple problems with him, basically athletically. Like, I think he doesn't have much pop in terms of, like, even, like, when he's playing pick and roll, stopping and just rising and hitting those difficult jumpers. Like, he has some sort of a floater and some mid-range game, but, like, he's not the type of guy like Markel Fultz, you will say, that can just rise easily and fluidly out of those sets. And, like, he's a super passer and a superb a shooter in terms of reading the when he has to shoot, when he has to pass, in terms of IQ. I think the main take to have with him is, like, he's super young, like, he's 17, but, like, he doesn't play like a 17-year-old, and that ends up making mistakes in terms of, like, reading his upside. Like, he was the same with Rubio. He was, like, farther along the curve than many prospects are, and it's just unrealistic to expect the same type of improvement and the same type of growing in terms of, like, when he gets older. And physically, he's, like, way, way beyond his peers in terms of age. He has, like, a super strong frame, and he moves fairly well. Like, he's super fluid, even if he's not that explosive. So you have to take all that into account. Like, he is absolute merit to be able to be, like, the second, third most consistent player on the pretty much this year the best EuroLeague team in Real Madrid. But, like, he hasn't really shown me that he can be that guy, that top upper echelon guy. Like, he's going to be a really good player at the next level, I'm convinced of that, but, like, it's more about scouting where the ceiling stops and where you are comfortable with him. And in terms of high schoolers, I've seen some Michael Porter Jr., I've seen a little bit of Ayton, but I haven't seen much more than that. I like Troy Brown Jr., that he's a commit for Oregon. I think he's an underrated guy in terms of, like, a passing wing that can do a little bit of everything. But that's pretty much my take. I haven't really seen as much as I would like in terms of the high school, the senior class.
What about you, Mark?
I don't really start to tune into the next year's class until the All-Star circuit, usually. I'll sort of get an idea of who the names are and maybe watch a mixtape here or there. But I don't have a lot of real knowledge about them. I will say Doncic looks awesome to me. and, like, based on what his skill set is, he's the clear number one to start. Having not scouted or looked at his stats in depth or anything like that. From afar, the 2018 class looks pretty good to me. There's a lot of size, a lot of skilled guys who also, I think, play defense, and it's hard to tell because the scouting reports I read are idiotic and dumb and are focusing on their low post moves rather than their defense. You've got DeAndre Ayton, you've got Brandon McCoy, Muhammad Bamba, all, like, legit 7-foot guys with long wingspans who block shots. They're all intriguing as more sort of new age centers to take over the league. Michael Porter Jr. looks really interesting. Doncic as well. There's some sort of combo wing guys, Kevin Knox, Troy Brown, who I know Cole knows more about than I do, who are intriguing. But for all of these guys, I'm sort of shooting blind still. I don't really know, and I won't start paying attention to them until the All-Star circuit, and sort of work on getting a better read on them during the summer, and then when they start playing college ball, like really watch intensely their first couple months to try to hone in a little bit more on what I think.
Yeah, I think overall my thoughts on the class are, I think the top three in the class are stronger than this class, just from my initial gathering. I think Michael Porter is awesome. I think he'd be the number one wing in this class, even over Josh, because he's more athletic and he can actually shoot. There's no poor indicators as far as his shot goes. So just the fact he's 6'10 and he has this athleticism and shooting combination, I think he'd be the first wing off the board. Doncic, I haven't seen too much of him. I've seen highlights and this guy looks like a freaking magician. And initially, I'd probably group him in like that Ben Simmons kind of archetype. So this is kind of what I do early on, is I kind of say, hey, this guy looks like this. Like DeAndre Ayton looks like kind of a unicorn big. I'm not sure if he has any playmaking to like ascend up to that category one tier as far as fives. But he looks like he can shoot threes. He's improved every time I've seen him. I've seen him a couple times in person now, and he's added passing a little bit. So really for him, you're looking at like, can he do anything off the dribble? And then you go down a little bit. I love Troy Brown. I brought that up before. I just think he's kind of a Chris Middleton kind of clone if he can shoot the ball pretty well. This class, for the most part, is viewed as really strong at the very top three or four, depending on how you feel about Bamba. Obviously, he'll have the longest arms in the league, so that you have to factor that in. But maybe not the same depth from like 4 to 14 at this juncture, even though I think it could be, because I've kind of soured on this current class a little bit in that range. So I think, as far as star power goes, you're looking at potentially three really, really useful archetypes, like maybe not franchise players, but like it looks like three all-star caliber players for sure. Trayvon Duval's the top point guard in this class. He's got a lot of vertical pop, and he definitely differentiates himself from the rest of the class as far as vertical athleticism. I haven't seen enough of him making reads on the move and stuff to really know in any kind of like ball screen action, like can he run an offense? I don't have any of that yet, but that's something to identify. Kevin Knox, like you brought up, Mark, he's a guy that can score a little bit. He's really smooth. Kind of reminds me a little bit of Tatum as far as swinging combo forward stuff. And he doesn't look like he has great feel, but this is all like based on a really, really limited sample at Adidas Nations. And I'm going to see most of these guys, hopefully, at Hoop Summit in a month and a half or so. So that'll be much more informative.
Yeah, and we are going to cover that in depth during the McDonald's All-American game and Hoop Summit. Like, we'll come back to these guys and we'll talk about them then. And we'll have better reads on them then than we do right now, when we really have very little tape. Very little high-level tape, too, which is part of what makes scouting high school so difficult, is these guys are just so overpowering compared to a lot of the competition they're playing against that you can't really understand if, like, what they're doing is because they're actually good at basketball or just because they're way bigger than everyone else. And so we'll have a better read on that in a couple months.
Hi, this is Maury Moreland Morrison here to tell you Geico has more than just great savings. Much more. Yes, while Geico could help you rack up more moolah faster than you can say metamorphosis, they've also been the fastest growing auto insurer for more than 10 years. That's more like it. Furthermore, Geico has fast and friendly claim service. That might seem like an oxymoron, but it's not. All the more reason to say no other auto insurer has more than Geico. Geico, expect great savings and a whole lot more.
Okay, we have two final questions, but let's skip to the Lakers now. Thanks, Tim Lawrence, for your question on thoughts on the big class. We'll get to those guys, Williams, and the guys we haven't covered as much, like Leaf and Allen, who's actually playing better for Texas recently, and Jawan Evans from Morty Silver Carp. So thank you very much for those questions, and we'll get to those in future episodes. But let's move on to the Lakers and just general scope of things. We're going to talk about their prospects, D'Angelo Russell, Brandon Ingram mostly, mix in some Julius Randle. So just, Javier, what are your general thoughts on D'Angelo Russell at this point?
Yeah, I think I really like didn't scout him as well as I should when he was in Ohio State, because I've seen, like, my main problem with him is his mechanics. Like, I have him really high in terms of shooting ability from his sole season at NCAA level. But, like, now with the Lakers, I mean, I know he had, like, a knee issue during the year. He has been out two times, I think, from it, like once in December, once last month. But like, I really like his footwork is all over the place. Like, even his hands, like, I think he tries to like quick up his release, like do it a little bit like Stephen Curry style, a little bit like he tends to like withdraw his hands way too fast. And it's the same with the footwork, like he doesn't align his feet all the time. He doesn't have the right position with his knees. I think he's much better of the catch than when he has to like do it pull-ups and stuff like that. He's not all that good there. And I think shooting ability for him is capital in terms of being able to taking advantage of his limit athleticism. Like, he's long, he's big. I think he's quite kind of a sneaky good posting up and even turning to his right shoulder. He can find space there. And he's still a really capable passer, especially in transition. But I think he has to put it together. I don't know if he has worked hard enough in his skill set. Like, I think he has the need to like work deep with a shooting coach, work deep with some type of like off-season scout and stuff like that, and just go rebrand and redo his mechanics, because that's the main issue I see with his shooting, other than even like the IQ or even reading when to shoot, when to pass. Like, I think he's capable as an off-ball shooter, so that's intriguing to me. But like, to be able to reach like a godly level, or like a being able to be a good talented initiator, being a guy that is able to run your offense, I think he needs to really improve those to be able to take advantage of the space he can make with his shot, shooting and his touch.
Mark, what are your thoughts?
Not much. I don't watch them all that much. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I haven't watched a whole lot of the Lakers recently. Stat-wise, he's not encouraging. It's starting to look scary. Maybe you should give yours first.
It's all good. I can echo.
Yeah, I was just fast. Like, Mark, I think he was much better stat-wise in the beginning of this season before the first knee problem he had. Like, the first month or, yeah. I mean, not even month, like maybe 3 weeks. He started strong, and then he completely went down after the knee. So I don't really know if he has gone then completely healthy since then.
That's a good point, yeah.
Javier touched on some really good stuff with the shooting mechanics and the footwork, the inconsistency there. This is something that he had to do well. Like, this was something he did well at Ohio State. He was in the 90th percentile shooting off the dribble. And that's kind of why he had such a lure in the draft, because he was kind of like the spread pick and roll. Kind of, he can shoot that scheme-changing three. And he just hasn't been able to do that this year. Like, his effective field goal shooting off the bounce is like 39.4. He's only 29% from three in those situations. Like, he needs to shoot that well, because he's not really a three-level scorer. He's more of a two-level scorer. His interior finishing isn't that great either. Like, he's got good size, but really it's all like that low percentage kind of floater. He's not really athletic, so he's not going to like adjust in midair and stuff. He doesn't get enough separation to really blow into the lane. You know, he uses some hang dribbles and stuff to freeze bigs, and he's okay at that. But I don't ever see him being like a high-level finisher. So really, it comes down to the shot, and really like, it's a lot about role. Like, I don't think he really knows what to do yet. He's getting a lot of pressure from the organization to be like a pure point, and that's something he's never really been in his life. He's more of a combo who has really good vision, but he's just acclimating the position. And there'll be games where he shoots like 2.5 times, and he just really loses himself. Like, he's forcing passes. He's turning the ball over way too much, almost 20% on pick and rolls, which for him, that's his bread and butter. It's too much. So converting those off the dribble looks is going to be huge for him. I'm still high on him because I think he's a really intelligent player. I just think that it's going to take a little bit longer with him to really acclimate. And that's something you see from point guards who aren't like elite athletes and don't just blow into the lane like a Derrick Rose. Like, those guys, the skill guys, take a little bit longer to comprehend, like, what are the openings? Like, when I come off the pick, who do I have? And it's not like the Lakers have like a really established infrastructure as far as like supporting cast. Like, they really don't have like a secondary playmaker that can do things for others, really. They have like Jordan Clarkson, who's more of a secondary scorer. Same with Lou Williams. Like, it's basically D'Angelo is the guy who has to handle everything. With Ingram,
they don't even have a pick and pop big. Like, nope. That's the main issue for him. Like, they don't even have spacing in that regard. Like, the older bigs can really shoot. Like, you will see it with Nance, especially even in the mid range. Like, he receives some passes sometimes, and he instead of like taking the shoot, he just dribbles and tries to like making a play because he's not comfortable with it. Like, they don't really have that guy even in the backcourt. Like, they don't really have shooters. Like, the only shooter they have had in terms of being an off-ball guy this year has been Nick Young, surprisingly. So it's like Lou Williams is a good shooter, but he's more of a guy that likes to create his own shot. So it's like really difficult for a guy like Russell to just really mess with his teammates, I would say.
Yeah, the pick and pop big part is crucial, because I mean, both Randall and Nance, those guys are in like the bottom 10th percentile as far as shooting. They just don't have it. They're mid-range guys. They haven't extended their range. Zubac has kind of been interesting for them, just because he's a really good screen center, because he's huge. But if he can do some stuff in advantage situations, so when they trap him in middle pick and roll, Russell will hit Zubats and he can actually make that secondary pass. And that's something, Javier, you noted when you were scouting Zubats, that he's a really good passer. And I didn't see that on film as much. I thought he was a decent passer. I didn't know it was to this level. So that's really given their offense an added dimension. But still, D'Angelo doesn't have an optimal, you know, he's ran pick and rolls majority of this season with Timofey Mozgov, who is just, that was a ridiculous signing in itself. I mean, like, that's just a way to, like, what do we talk about all the time? How saturated the big man market is, and you spend $16 million a year on, like, not even a, like, a, like a basically a backup caliber, like, 10, 15 minutes a game big. So he's, like, their fifth best center now.
Yeah, they have a perfectly capable backup in Tariq Black already, so it's really confusing for me. And, like, the same with Larry Nance. Like, those guys are, if they're not going to be able to suit it a little bit at least, they are going to be better off as centers, even if they are not completely capable of protecting the rim, especially in the case of Julius Randle, although he has seen some, he has shown some ability, I think, even switching. I think, like, the thing with the Lakers is that they've been trying to build up these rosters, a switching system because of the personnel they have. And I think in the end, if you are going to have to do that with guys like D'Angelo and guys like Clarkson that can't really contain guards of the dribble, like, you are going to end up to have some type of rim protector behind them. Like, it's the same in Portland with McCollum and Lillard. Like, you end up needing those guys, and they don't have that. Like, even, like, Zubac is okay there. Like, he's enormous, and he is really good at verticality, so he can get there. But, like, other than that, like, they don't really have a guy like that in the roster, and they don't really have a pick and pop big as well. Like, we will talk about that before. And, like, moving on to Ingram, like, I think he suffered a little bit from the same thing with the roster construction. Like, he's a guy that needs to play for me to create advantage from his handle and his advanced feel of the game, like when he can put it on the floor and really dribble past his man. Like, he has to play a little bit more as a four, and, like, it's difficult for them to play him there because they had Randle, they had Nance, even they have Deng that has to play there to be effective offensively, so it's difficult for him to create a space, and his shooting hasn't been there just yet. I think he gets people on, like, people get on their body, on his body way too much, and they bother him. And, like, he needs to build up physically as well, but, like, I think whenever they move him to the four, I have seen, like, it's one of these cases where the tape doesn't really make sense with the stats. Like, the stats are really bad for Randle, but for Ingram, sorry. But, like, the tape I've seen is encouraging enough to not be low on him, I would say. Like, I think when he's able to build up a little bit and, like, really move down a position, I think he's going to be a really good player, at least as a starting level forward. I don't really know the ceiling, if the ceiling is there in terms of a star level player or even a middle star. But, like, he does a lot of things well that you would like from that position.
Yeah, I mean, you can see the lack of strength really evident. He's finishing, like, 30%, 36% of his offense comes at the rim, and he's only making 44% of that. So that's one of, like, the outlier low parts, because he just can't finish through contact. Like, he, every time he gets inside, he gets knocked off his spot, and, like, eventually he might have enough strength to really use that length extension at the rim. But right now, he's kind of in limbo with his body. We see that with the younger guys. Same with Dragan Bender. It's kind of like you have to give this guy 2-3 years. He's a long-term prospect. But I'm still high on him. He still has high feel. He can run a pick and roll. Luke's been really good this year about allowing him to initiate offense. But, like, the shooting, that's something that ties back to Mark's Justice Winslow point. And that was kind of the same thing with Ingram. Like, 41% from three in college, but the free throw percentage, I believe, was, what, 68 or something like that? Like,
yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't clean. Like, everybody was giving this guy Durant comps, which is ridiculous as it is, because he wasn't nearly as fluid off the dribble as Durant was. And he just doesn't have, like plus shooting indicators. Like, we knew he could shoot a little bit, but that hasn't translated. And that's just another lesson to learn when you look at these guys.
Yeah, I have a quick point to make about the Lakers overall, which is that I don't take issue with either of their picks at number two the last couple of years. I think Brandon Ingram was probably the right guy, and I think D'Angelo Russell, in retrospect, was not, should have been Kristaps Porzingis, but at the time, there was a pretty easy argument to be made for Russell to be that pick. And we're now in, what, this is year four
three.
Of the Lakers being terrible. And I think it shows the this is going to be a point in Sam Hinkie's favor. It shows the difficulty of succeeding in tanking. Like, you really, if you don't get that guy, you've just been bad for no reason. Like, Russell and Ingram are probably going to become nice, useful players, but neither one is going to be like that number one guy probably. And what do the Lakers have to show for the last 3 years? If they don't get Fultz, not much. And if their pick conveys to the Sixers this year, they've got very little to show. So it just, I think it's a point in favor of maximizing every opportunity you can to attain that number one guy, that top guy in whatever draft you're in, whether it's Joel Embiid, whether it's Karl Anthony Towns, whether it's Ben Simmons, whether it's Markelle Fultz this year, that one guy who actually has the potential to get you over the top. Because if you don't, there's a chance that you're going to be missing an awful lot and you have attained nothing through years of putridity, basically.
No, that's a great point. But if the franchise is at least knows enough to know that they don't have that guy and they don't move or make weird moves like Orlando has, for example, is another example of a team that has been not lucky enough. Like, it's just like you have a second draft pick in a really poor draft in 2013 overall. At least that was the feeling, and ended up being a bit better than expected just because of Giannis and even Rudy Gobert at the end of the first. But like overall, it's one of the probably bottom two drafts of the last 20 years, even with those two guys blossoming lately. But like, it's just bad luck sometimes. Like, even if you end up with the second pick in the draft, like, you can end up in a poor draft class. So you have to do it several years in a row probably to end up maximizing those efforts. And at least if your franchise is smart enough to know that you don't have those guys, you can avoid those type of mistakes in terms of moving picks and moving guys like Orlando has done. But like, it's also depending on your management and your ownership, right? Because those guys might get tired after 3 or 4 years of losing and they won't use a quick fix, and that's never going to work, or never going to work to the degree of being competitive enough to warrant that the tanking was worth it, kind of.
It just goes to show how hard it is to land these franchise caliber players.
Yeah.
Like, Embiid made this whole process movement worth it just because you have that franchise level talent. But for most teams like the Lakers, you're going to have a bunch of pretty good players, maybe potentially really good players, which is why you see more of like these motion schemes where it's getting everybody the ball moves, because that's a way to counteract not having that just ridiculous LeBron type who can just initiate consistently and stuff like that. So I think that's what I see the Lakers becoming, is a bunch of potentially high-level players. Like Ingram and D'Angelo, I think they're going to be okay. I'm much less sold on Randall. He predictably fell off as far as his early seasons.
We all hate Randall.
It's he started out and it wasn't sustainable as far as his finishing goes. He's back down to about 50% at the rim. He was hovering around 64. His passing didn't hold up in the half court as far as facilitating. I like him as like a guy who can grab and go in transition. He can make those reads, and like, he does a really good job of like running right into shooting or the shooters' bodies, like the guys that are guarding the shooters, and just gives them an easy like drag screen action. So he does a good job at that, but for the most part, he's an elite rebounder. He can't shoot. He's not a high level passer. He's not going to give you any rim protection. He can switch, so he gives you some defensive value, but like we've talked about, they just don't have that franchise guy, and they really do need Fultz. But right now, like, the decision between Ball and Jackson is absolutely fascinating to me with them, just because I feel like Ball would be a tailor-made offensive fit in Luke's system. But I don't know if D'Angelo plus Ball is tenable on defense, whereas like, if you put Jackson and Ingram on the wings, you're going to have a scrunched court on offense probably, but holy hell, man, the defense.
Yeah, I hope that at least they don't make the decision based on the guys they signed last summer. Like, they don't think that they have Luol Deng there for 4 years and they have to pick Ball because Jackson doesn't have a place, or they don't want to move down Ingram a position, even if that's the right decision, because Julius Randle was drafted by them in 2012, like 2014, sorry. Like, that's a thing that can be dangerous for them. Like, if they are really in love with their players or with their decisions, like a couple of years ago, those can really derail the rebuilding efforts if they mismanage this draft pick, if they end up having it, right? That's a main focus for them this year, and that's a main question mark. Like, Ball is tailor-made probably for that system, and like, he's a local product, so he's going to have a lot going for him. But like, if you think Jackson has a higher ceiling and the higher upside, and he has like a better chance of being that guy for you, even if the chance is only like if he hits his 90 percentile or something like that, you might have to go with that, even if the fit is not as clean. Like, that's the main take here for me, and it's going to be really tricky for them to make that decision.
Yeah, definitely. And that's definitely going to be something that probably emerges. Right now, they're positioned at number 3 overall, so maybe the decision will be made easy for them, depending on what Phoenix does, if the lottery odds hold. But that's definitely...
They're probably not going to have a pick, Cole.
Well, some people would like that, for sure. That's really all I have to say about it outside of, I think the Lakers are in a decent spot. I think Luke has a pretty strong grasp. I think his coaching hasn't been to the level I thought it would be. Like, he struggles with when to put the starters back in. He plays their vets too much. But right now, both Deng and Mozgov's not even playing, and Deng comes off the bench. So I think they realize what they have as a product, and I trust them to make the right decision in the draft. I think that's one thing that Mitch has done pretty well is draft the right. If he's still there, he drafts pretty well. So I'm not like worried about the franchise overall.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
All right, guys. Mark, do you want to get us out of here?
Yeah. Oh, because I normally say thanks to everyone. Thanks everyone for listening in. Yes. Sorry, I'm just sort of space cadet-y today. Thanks everyone for tuning in. I have nothing to plug. So Cole, if you do, feel free to do that.
I just wrote a Jahlil Okafor is he salvageable piece, which was condemned by our own Mark Whittington. So if you guys want to read that.
No, I didn't condemn it. I didn't condemn it. No, see, literally the most frustrating Okafor play that happens so frequently, I'm so sick of it, is where he's like 3 seconds late on a rotation, so a point guard will make a 5-foot floater or something, and the like guard has already released his shot, and Okafor like late with the ball already released pretends to contest the shot, and it's like, dude, maybe box out, get the rebound instead. Like, we all know that you missed this rotation, and you didn't include one of those clips, so it was a worthless
piece. There you go. Look for that, and I got some trade deadline stuff coming out for the Step Back this week. And as usual, tune into Almighty Baller, the podcast network, and listen to other podcasts like Ode to Odin. And definitely give us an iTunes ranking if you can, as long as it's good, of course, and any kind of review would be helpful. You can hit us up on email at whatsondraftpod@gmail.com. So, yeah, we definitely like interacting. We love doing the mailbag stuff. So if you guys have anything you want us to cover, please let us know.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, thanks a lot for the questions, and we will look forward to do that again soon enough, because it's always good to check with people are thinking about the program and just thinking about the prospects in general, so we can actually add to the discussion with that from questions from the mailbag. So that's great.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Hi, this is Maury Moreland Morrison here to tell you Geico has more than just great savings. Much more. Yes, while Geico could help you rack up more moolah faster than you can say metamorphosis, they've also been the fastest growing auto insurer for more than 10 years. That's more like it. Furthermore, Geico has fast and friendly claim service. That might seem like an oxymoron, but it's not. All the more reason to say no other auto insurer has more than Geico. Geico, expect great savings and a whole lot more.